keeping you current on all things criminal. This is Crime Feed.
Crime Feed.
With Darren Kevinoki and Lonnie Coombs.
Welcome to Investigation Discovery's Crime Feed podcast. I'm Darren Kevinoki.
And I'm Lonnie Coombs.
My partner in crime. And we are covering the ripped from the headlines cases that everyone is talking about. Lonnie, what are you talking about?
Well, I'll tell you, the case right now that's in the headlines everywhere is James Holmes.
Yep, fresh verdict.
Right. Actually, starting the death penalty phase today, the jury did find him guilty. They did not buy the defense of not guilty by reason of insanity. And as you know, this was the young man who killed 12 people in a Colorado movie theater, wounded 70 more people. It was a Batman movie, caught a lot of headlines at that time. And
he was ultimately convicted of 165 counts of a variety of crimes, including murder and attempted murder.
Exactly. But there was a lot of talk about his mental illness, about whether he was schizophrenic. And it was an interesting trial because a lot of doctors agreed on both the prosecution and the defense and said, look, this guy is schizophrenic. But of course, it comes down to, is he legally insane? Now, in Colorado, it's actually up to the prosecution to overcome the burden once the defense says we're going to claim not guilty by reason of insanity. That's very rare. It's usually up to the defense.
What's that burden that prosecutors have to get over?
Obviously, they have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he was legally sane
at the time.
Right. And as we know, there's a big difference between being mentally ill or, you know, crazy, as we know, and legally sane, which means did you know what you were doing was right or wrong?
Did you get right from wrong? What was interesting to me, though, as to the guilt phase, obviously, as you said, the penalty phase starts now. Mm-hmm. On the guilt phase, the speed at which those jurors returned their verdicts, when it took the judge an hour or so just to read the verdicts. Yeah. They were back there deliberating for 12 hours, which sounds like it may be a lot of time, but not when you consider the sheer number of counts that they had to deal with. It actually, in the context of all of that, was a swift and certain rejection of the defense's insanity notions.
Which I thought was interesting because I recognize that a lot of jurors nowadays are rejecting the insanity defense. They don't like it. And especially in a case like this where it's so horrific, where so many people were killed, so many people were injured. However, looking at the actual evidence, I was thinking there's actually a lot of evidence here that this guy was mentally ill, that he was schizophrenic, and that he was delusional, that he had these massive delusions about what he was doing. And, you know, they had his journals, which had a lot of ranting on and on. And you could see just where his mind was not in reality. He'd talk about truth. He'd talk about you know, the value of human life. And if there was ever a case where the prosecution and the defense had a lot to work with, it was in this case, and yet it didn't matter to this jury.
Well, if you're on that jury, Lonnie, are you voting not guilty by reason of insanity? Are you sufficiently swayed in looking at everything that you saw that the prosecution wouldn't be able to meet their burden to prove sane beyond a reasonable doubt?
You know, I actually thought that there was evidence that he was delusional, that he was in this delusion, that he felt that killing these people was actually going to add to his self-worth, you know, that it was kind of like a video game for him, that he was getting points off how many people he killed. I mean, there was a lot of evidence of that. However, there was also some troubling stuff, the premeditation, the planning, the step that he took to protect himself. But remember, you can actually have premeditation and trying to protect yourself within your delusion. That can be part of your delusion.
Absolutely. It can be part of your delusion. The problem that I have, though, is, and it's just so funny because obviously you're a former prosecutor. I'm a defense lawyer. Mm-hmm. Yet sometimes I feel like we're in one of those SWAT personality movies because I look at this and the first thing in my mind is being able to compare and contrast what I call being two full scoops of crazy with legally insane, mm-hmm. which, as we've talked about, means not being able to distinguish right from wrong. And it's the things that he did that, to me, showed an understanding that what he was doing was wrong. The booby trapping of his apartment, things like that, that suggest okay, here's somebody who appreciated that in that moment, he knew that this was something that society frowned upon. He knew that this was something that wasn't okay.
Or was that part of his delusion, that needed to be part of what he was doing? As far as, I mean, in his delusion, he thought that taking human life was a good thing. It was adding to his self-worth. That was his delusion.
But if you're really in that delusion, do you need to do things to cover up your crime? It's like somebody who shoots people and then picks up the shell casings afterwards. Well, you don't need to pick up the shell casings unless you appreciate that what you've done was wrong and now you want to avoid detection. I agree with you that there's an enormous relationship, though, between mental health or lack thereof and criminality and the criminal justice system. And this is one of the big problems that I've had, is that in our justice system, we focus a lot on what I call solving symptoms, but never dealing with the underlying problem. Mm-hmm. You know, we lock people up for taking an action, and we, of course, we warehouse them with other people that take those same kinds of action. But that's not the real problem. The real problem is that the action is born in thought. And while they're incarcerated, we do very, very little to address the underlying thought disorders. And then when people get out of custody, thinking in the same broken way that they did when they went in, of course, they're going to take those same ridiculous actions, because mm-hmm. that's just how it goes. And we scratch our heads and wonder and say, well, why do we have such a high recidivism rate, which, by the way, is estimated by some experts to be somewhere around either 2/3 or 75%, depending on which study you believe. And it seems like the fundamental problem there is we're not doing enough to address the real underlying trouble.
Well, I find it that this discussion is coming up more and more, and I think it's extremely important. And that is the role that mental illness has in a lot of these cases. A lot of the people that are incarcerated, we're finding, have been evaluated as mentally ill. They're even starting to look now at all of the serial killers or mass killings that we've had, you know, in the last few years, and how many of those people were on prescribed right. drugs. I mean, there's
it's a
list
huge
here.
Issue.
Dylan Roof, the guy we're going to talk about in a little bit, the South Charleston, South Carolina shooter. He was on some prescription drugs. We had James Holmes, this one. He was on some prescription drugs. They found antidepressants and anti-anxiety drugs in his home when they searched it. Adam Lanza, remember the guy who shot 20 students and killed 20 students and 6 adults at Sandy Hook?
Right.
He also was apparently on some prescribed drugs, and they're starting to say, look, how do we handle
the correlation?
That?
Yeah,
exactly.
And but people on the other side will offer these arguments and say, well, wait a second, each one of those killers ate breakfast that day, mm-hmm. so is breakfast cereal the causative factor? I mean, yeah. So there's a lot that people dig into, but my wondering to you, Lonnie, is here we are, penalty phase is starting now. Is he going to get the death penalty? Holmes going to get the death penalty?
And once again, an interesting question, mixing mental illness with the death penalty. Now, some states have actually done some legislation and said, look, you can't put somebody who is mentally ill, you know, you can't execute them. But we have to decide, you know, what is mental illness? Does this qualify? Is it fair to do? And I'll tell you, I think that should he and will he are two different questions.
So let's hear two different answers. So will he get the death penalty, just knowing what you know about this juror? Because it's the same jurors that are going to go back and deliberate about this.
I actually think that even though it's the same jurors and they came back so quickly, I think there's a chance they might not, just because of all the mental illness.
I say 100%.
They will.
They will. The carnage is just too much to ignore.
And as we're going to see, you know, starting today, we're going to hear over and over again these very traumatic recitations from the victims themselves coming in and talking to the jury about what happened. And
so should he get the death penalty?
I think actually, should he? Maybe not, because of the mental illness. Will he? Maybe. Yeah. I'm gonna switch on that. Maybe.
That sounds like a definitive maybe.
Yeah, it's a maybe both ways, right?
Well, if I may, perhaps something mm-hmm. that's a little bit more, shall we say, lighthearted in the legal system. Let's talk about a custody battle.
Mm-hmm.
I know these are often emotionally charged and can get really, really crazy. This one may be especially so, because it's a custody battle over a cat. We're not.
Oh, boy.
So a woman lost her cat. She had rescued a stray, and then had moved. Was in the middle of moving, and the cat got out. Cat had a chip in its, I believe when they implant the chip, those locator chip, I believe it goes in the ear.
Okay, now I don't know what a chip is. It a GPS? What does it actually
it's not
do?
Not a GPS. It's like a like an identification tag.
Okay,
it's a chip that's going to have identifying information concerning the true owner of the animal in question. So so basically, we have the cat who went missing. And the cat's owner at the time put up all kinds of, you know, lost my kitty cat posters, and but to no avail. And there was then the finder of the lost cat, who never got the chip scanned, never figured out that there was a previous owner, but who has raised that cat as if her own. And now all of this has come to light. And now there is a legal battle afoot over who the true owner of that cat is. Huh. Is it the original owner who lost it, or is it the new owner who has given it a good and loving home for all of these years?
You know, when you hear about this case, you would think it was an actual child. And I know for some people, their cats and their dogs are like their children. In fact, I think the second owner of this cat considers this cat like her grandchild.
Right. Well, she rescued the cat. Apparently, somehow the cat made it to another, to a cat orphanage, and the second owner actually paid $50.
Right, like she was saving. It was like a rescue.
Yeah,
right?
So yeah. I don't think anybody is disputing the good intentions of anybody here, but now they are now they're fighting like cats and dogs.
Well, and the emotions are very strong. I mean, the first owner is saying, look, I raised this cat as a baby. I put the chip in so that if anything happened, you know, they should have been able to bring the cat back to me. And then the second owner is like, I didn't know. It's been years now. I've been taking care of this cat. The cat's attached to me. I'm attached to the cat. It's like, you know, Solomon trying to split the baby, right?
Well, I get that there's an emotional component to animal ownership. I, for example, am a pet owner. I've got dogs that have their own Twitter account. I've got these two Pomeranians, Willis and Cash, and you can follow them on Twitter at Willis and Cash, and they put up photos of themselves doing all kinds of cute little Pomeranian dog.
Okay, but,
and by the way, they get more likes on their photos than I get on mine. So I get how people are with their animals.
But animals aren't actually treated under the law like children. So under the law, what do you think the judge is going to do?
Well, look, under the law, they're what they call chattel property. They're not like children at all. It's more like finding a piece of lost property on the side of the road. But in this case, I think ultimately the second owner is going to get it. Because the second owner is what lawyers would call a bona fide purchaser for value without notice of the defect, meaning that here it was the person who's second in line who paid $50 at this cat rescue without having any notice that there's a problem. If anything, the cat rescue, who seemingly would know about these things like ear chips, would be the ones who would be responsible for seeing if that animal was chipped. I think the one byproduct out of all of this that's great is that people are now talking more and more about the prevalence of those microchips.
Yeah, and that you should actually check to see if any animal that you purchase or that you find has that chip. You know, there's an interesting side note to this. There's another thing that's going on right now called dog flipping. Have you heard of that?
Is it like trading up your dog for a more expensive dog after the property, after the dog value goes up?
I'm not sure.
Like, is it like house flipping?
No. So dog flipping essentially is when a dog is either stolen or the dog just gets lost on its own, and this new person comes in and takes the dog either because he stole it or he found it, and then they turn around to sell it at a high value on eBay or whatever, and then the first owner, the legitimate owner, essentially has to pay for their own dog, somewhat extortion, some people might think. It was like, you know, there's a bad intent there by the seller.
I think I'm a dog flipping victim. I had acquired through legal and lawful means a French bulldog, Wanda, because we had a subsequent Wanda after this mishap, and Wanda One went missing from my backyard, and
expensive dog.
Oh my God, French bulldog! Come on, these things. Do you know that French bulldogs have to be born by cesarean section, or at least that's what I was told while they were getting all the money from me about why was I need to pay all this damn money? But you know what? In the dog flipping world, that may be a crime where the, and now I'm using air quotes, the victims don't even know it, because if somebody came to me about Wanda
yeah.
and said, hey, found your dog. How about a reward? Like, I would gladly
have paid
for one. I would be the victim of a dog flipping crime.
Would you have been suspicious?
No, I would have been so overwhelmed with gratitude. I had a crying child going, where's Wanda?
So you would have paid the amount, whatever amount.
With pleasure.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Well, that's why this crime is working out so well.
Yes.
So anyways, that's the latest thing. Watch out for it if you have pets.
Can I make a shameless self-promotional plug that if you're accused of dog flipping or any other crime, call 1-800-NO-CUFFS.
Oh, my goodness. Darren, moving on. Okay. This is a case that we actually covered, the Sandra Bland case.
Mm.
As we expected, this thing is continuing to blow up. And there's a latest thing, a new thing that's just happening today. The police have released the dash cam video from the arresting officer, and I'm just going to go through briefly. A lot of people are just seeing the small part of the clip, but they actually released about 45 minutes of this dash cam. I mean, a lot of the video is there.
But conspiracy theorists or people that have been skeptical about this case or inquisitive about this case look at this and say, well, my goodness, there was, I don't know, I guess a cover-up or there have been
There's a little glitches.
There's some glitches.
But the police department came out right away and said, look, those glitches were due to the way we downloaded it, and they put out a second video that was supposedly not going to have any of those glitches. So
the people that are complaining about glitches, what? It's really kind of a false
issue.
It's
a technical thing, yeah. I don't think that at this point that they've shown that that's something to really focus on. However, the videotape itself is really fascinating. So it shows the stop and the officer approaching, and he says, look, you know, you changed lanes without putting on your blinker, and I need your information, how long you've been here. And he's quite pleasant and polite and asking her questions. She's not answering very friendly.
But in terms of this officer, sorry to interrupt, but this officer, friendly and polite, didn't they show something in that tape
about
a prior...
That's what I want to talk about. There's a lot of people are only seeing a small part of this clip. However, it was interesting that the police included a larger part on that video, which actually showed the ending of the traffic stop he did prior to stopping Ms. Bland. And that was another traffic stop. Apparently, we don't know exactly what the reason was for, but he's talking, and you can hear the audio, which is nice. He's talking to it sounds like a woman in the car about not having the insurance, and he's saying, make sure you talk to your dad and have him send you proof of your insurance, and here's the warning, and very friendly very kind and solicitous back and forth, and he ends up just giving that person a warning. Then he gets in the car, she drives off, he does a U-turn, and he comes up the street, and Ms. Bland's car is ahead, and he's coming up kind of fast, and she does what I would do. She pulls over to the lane next to her so that he can come up next to her. Instead of going past, he pulls over and he pulls her over because when she changed lanes essentially to get out of his way, she didn't put on the blinker.
So he's coming up fast behind her. She sees it. We're inferring that she sees now that there's this law enforcement officer
coming up fast. Well, we're not inferring because she actually says this on the
video. Okay, so she pulls over and she doesn't does not use her blinker when she's pulling over.
Well, you can see that too. She doesn't use her blinker.
I just always like to throw in the word allegedly. So she sees the cop coming up fast. She pulls over to get out of his way. He doesn't use her blinker when she pulls over, and then he now makes the traffic stop on her for not using the blinker.
Right, exactly. So
I'd
they
be
have this
conversation.
Well, yeah. We're having this conversation, then he says, I'm going to go back and I'm going to do the information. He goes back to the car. He's gone for quite a while. When he comes back up, he says to her, and apparently she's smoking now because she's been waiting for him for a while, and he says, hey, you seem irritated. And she says, yeah, I'm irritated because you were pulling up fast behind me. I pulled over to get out of your way, and then you end up pulling me over. And then he says, are you finished? And she says, you asked me the question. So now you can see kind of the dynamic here. And he then says, please put out your cigarette. Or I'm not sure if he used the word please, but he said, put out your cigarette. Now, there's no law on the Texas books that says she can't smoke in her car, she can't smoke in front of a police officer, and she says back to him, I'm just smoking in my car. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, but at this point, you can tell from the way the situation and just the description of this, how it's emotionally ratcheting up, and each one of them is offended by the other, and it's hard to gracefully and elegantly retreat from that kind of a situation once it starts to get...
And that's where it goes very quickly. that he tells her to get out of the car. She says, I don't have to. It's not, you know, I have my rights. I don't have to get out of the car. You just pull me up for a traffic stop. I'm not being arrested.
And you know how much officers love people that, that are full of defiance.
Well, then from going from pleasant and friendly and I'm just going to give you a warning, which he didn't tell her. He tells her later that he was just going to give her a warning, but he was planning to. He then tells her to get out. He opens the car door. He tries to force her out. She refuses. Mm. He pulls her out at taser and he says to her, I'll light you up.
Wait. He pulls her out at, holding
point.
A taser?
Yes, yes. And then she gets out, and that's where it kind of goes into, they go over to the side, and that picks up where the video from the bystander, where there's this physical altercation as he's putting her handcuffs on her. They go down to the ground. He says she ends up kicking him, elbowing him.
Citizens are going to behave badly from time to time. That's part of the role that I play as a law enforcement officer. I just have to know that law enforcement officer, either as social worker function or just in the course of interacting with people in these really rough environments. By the way, any job where the number one rule of your job is make it home alive at the end of your shift, I have a massive amount of respect for law enforcement officers, but I also have a high level of expectations and I expect them to rise above. And it's the law enforcement officer that's got the training and the experience to be able to de-escalate a situation. And it sounds like he's escalating that situation where all of a sudden he's got the taser out.
Well, and the policy, the police officers right off the bat, they said, look, he violated the policy, which is, regardless of the circumstances, you stay polite and courteous throughout the entire time. Now, there's an argument to be said, look, citizens, and I would definitely teach my children, which I did, and any of my family members, you also stay courteous and respectful throughout the whatever type of contact you have, because it'll only go better for everyone if you don't mouth off. And it, you can hear in this tape and see as it goes on and as she's being pulled out, she starts using swear words at him. She starts calling him a pussy. She starts saying, I can't wait till we go into court because I'm going to, you know, show everybody what you did. And do you think you're a big man? So she's definitely, you know, challenging him verbally.
She's fanning the flames.
Exactly.
Here.
However, what's very interesting legally is he says, look, I had just written you up for a warning. I was just going to give you a warning. That changes, apparently, when she talks about the cigarette. She doesn't want to put the cigarette out. That doesn't change legally, though. Changing your attitude, if you come across somebody who you're going to just give a warning to, but they fail the attitude test, which we always, that's what we used to call it, yep, when somebody starts to mouth off.
You bet.
That does not equate to legal probable cause to then change it to an arrest. So that's an issue for the police officer. Just because the citizen shows a bad attitude, that doesn't necessarily give you more reason to be able to arrest.
Well, I'm all in favor of the transparency and that this videotape is out there so that everybody can actually look objectively and listen to the audio and make their own assessments.
But I think it's really important, too, is to remember now, what does this do about the death investigation? This tape has kind of taken the focus off of what's going on with the suicide, quote unquote, which the first they were saying it was a suicide. Now they're saying, hey, we're making this a full-on murder investigation. The prosecutors actually said, look, we want to look for trace DNA on the victim's body, you know, clothes, fiber, hair of anybody who might have interacted with her to see if they can show any type of evidence that would show that this was an intentional killing as opposed to...
Well, they interacted with her where? Because she's there in the cell, obviously. Yeah. And what's interesting to me is I think about, okay, now we have this tape. What does this have to do with the death investigation? What does this mean? I think it provides context so that we can see what the motive might be for the police. If there was police involvement, this would certainly show motive. But more importantly, it also tells me that this is a woman who wanted her day in court. She wanted the fight. And the person that wants the fight and that says to the officer, oh, I can't wait to have my day in court with you, that is not a person who then is going to commit suicide.
Right. And we know because she had a Facebook page where she did hashtag Sandra Speaks, and she would talk about, you know, injustices that were done by police officers. Now she has her own situation where she's telling the police officer the last thing that it appears that she would do is silence her own voice intentionally.
Speaking of injustices, is that a segue?
Sure.
Speaking of injustices, how about this one? You're a dad. Oh, this one just gets me going because I'm a dad, right? So you're a dad and you've got two daughters that are aged 4 and 7. And they are solicited for sex by a 67-year-old man.
Ugh.
Right? Doesn't that just make your blood boil?
Yeah.
And so this guy, this dad, Kenneth Faulkner is his name, he does the right thing. he turns this guy into the authorities, and they actually charge him with a crime. And the 67-year-old guy, his name is Thomas Williams. Thomas Williams pleads guilty to two counts of solicitation of a minor. But what happens? Does Thomas Williams do any time in jail? No. Based on his guilty plea, the judge puts him on probation. No jail time. Mm. So now there they are right after that sentencing hearing, and Dad is pissed. Mm. So they go out in the hallway outside the courtroom or outside the courthouse, and according to Dad, this defendant Williams winked and smiled at him, and then when he asked the old man why he did it, all the old guy said was he didn't know. Mm. And Dad saw red and acted on it. And kicked his ass, right?
Yeah.
So and really gave him a decent beat down. It's reported that that Faulkner punched Williams in the face, he threw him down a staircase, and he reportedly threw at least 10 punches before anybody tried to break up the fight. Now, Faulkner, the dad, is charged with felony aggravated assault, and he has now spent more time in jail than the guy who's pleaded guilty for solicitation of his 4 and 7-year-old daughters.
And he could do quite a bit of time on that charge, depending, yeah, especially on the injuries. And 67-year-old man, he probably was injured pretty badly.
Absolutely. And he's next going to be in court on August 11th. It's interesting. He's become something of a local celebrity over this.
Yeah.
For taking the law into his own hands.
So do you think he did the right thing?
Oh,
you think
my
that's
God.
Okay?
You know, I have such a tension in my heart over this, because if I was in that situation and those were my daughters and that guy winked and smiled at me after he'd just gotten out of court pleading guilty and doing no jail time, mm-hmm, yeah, every fiber of my being would want to act out in exactly that way. And, we say there should be no vigilante justice, right, and don't take the law into your own hands. I don't know. Maybe I just think about, what was that great movie? Billy Jack. Billy Jack was the guy, and he stood up for other people. And sometimes, yeah, that meant kicking somebody else's ass. So, I'd be lying if I said I wouldn't go after that guy.
Or more recent example, maybe Dexter, the vigilante serial killer. Right. Well, I'll tell you, it's interesting because I understand, I feel for that father. I mean, a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old, these are just babies, essentially. But I have to say, we talk about vigilanteism, and the best example I can think of is, remember Ellie Nessler, the mom who he was a young boy, preteen boy who had been sexually molested, and they were in court with the accused, and she pulled out a gun and killed him. And my son was about the same age, and I was like, I totally get it. I understand, yep, why she did it. But then you see since then what's happened to that family, and it's not been good for the young son. It's not been good for the mother who ended up being in prison. So while it seems like emotionally you feel like you
totally
want to get
it,
your justice that way, in the long run, I don't think it's good for anyone involved.
I agree. It's not good public policy.
Well, and I also think you have to say something about the judge finding that there might have been dementia going on here. I mean, if there's some dementia going on, perhaps he didn't legitimately know what he was doing.
If there is dementia going on, then maybe there should have been an issue around his guilty plea. I will buy that we are a nation of laws and that we need to comport ourselves with that. But, this is a case that, to me, as a defense lawyer, I think of only two words: jury nullification. Mm. So this dad may be technically guilty, but if Dad goes and puts his case, his aggravated assault case, in front of 12 members of his community on jury duty, oh my God, I think he walks. And oh wait, what jurisdiction is this in? Tennessee? Yeah, they're going to give this guy a key to the city.
Mm. Well, you never know with juries.
To my,
right,
Southern friends, yeah, they're very big on fathers sticking up for their girls.
All right. Well, okay. We'll have to wait and see on that one.
Yes, that's my pregame prediction. Dad walks.
All right. This next case is, I think, a sad case all around. And I think we both agree, both from the prosecution side.
Sad in what sense? Like the defense lawyer didn't get paid?
No. No, sadden what happened to the two young kids here. We're talking about a 12-year-old and a 13-year-old, brother and sister, who back in 1999 shot and killed their father's girlfriend. Now, the situation essentially was that they were living with their father, his girlfriend, and then there was a visiting male family relative. And the allegations, according to these two young kids, is that this male relative was sexually abusing both of them. The 12-year-old boy and the 13-year-old girl, and that they had talked about it and they had tried to get help and no one would listen. In fact, the child services has actually come in and done an investigation and said, yeah, we see evidence of sexual abuse, but they did nothing about it. They closed down the investigation. Just a few days after that, the 13-year-old daughter was in the bathtub and this, she says, this male relative came in and sat there and masturbated as he watched her, and she cried without being able to do anything, without getting any help. She wrote in her journal that night, I'm going to kill them all. And she sat down with her 12-year-old brother and they decided that they were going to use their dad's gun and they were going to kill the alleged abuser and also the father and the girlfriend, because they said they knew what was going on. They did nothing to help them.
And they didn't stop. They didn't protect them.
So what happens is they...
Oh my God, 12 and 13.
Yeah, 12 and 13. So they get the gun, they go and they shoot and kill the girlfriend, but instead of saying, okay, yay, let's go get the other ones, they panic. They're so scared. They're upset. So they run and hide in the woods. They're caught a day later. They are actually arrested and tried as adults. 12 and 13-year-old. They're tried as adults. They're the youngest murderers in the United States.
And you have all that evidence of premeditation and deliberation and planning. And as a prosecutor.
Because of what they told. I mean, they're the ones who told them, right? They told law enforcement, this is what we did.
Right.
It's based on their own statements.
Amazing.
Yeah. So then they decide as a plea deal, because they're facing life in prison, they take a plea deal. They both plead to second degree murder and they get 18 years as a sentence because they're tried as adults, not as children.
So so they get what's called a determinate sentence,
yes,
meaning a fixed number of years. So at least you know you've got a release date as opposed to what they call an indeterminate sentence.
Right, where you could be in forever.
You could be in for your entire life.
Well, they're actually getting out. The brother is now 29 years old. He's supposed to get out this month. And the sister, who's 30 years old, is supposed to get out next month. But I'll tell you, I don't know that was the just thing to do in that case.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting about this, and I get, by the way, why they would enter into that kind of a plea deal.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you're facing the possibility of life in prison and you're being offered a way out that has a fixed number of years, then obviously
you're
that's
stuck.
Yeah. You
don't
take
have a
that
good
deal.
Choice. Yeah.
No. I mean, or you better have ice water in your veins to make that kind of gamble. When you're talking about a 12 and a 13-year-old kid tried as adults, that blows me away.
Yeah.
Because when we talk about children in the justice system, there has been judicial recognition that the brains of children are just different than adults.
Actually, it's up to age 26 before your frontal lobe actually fully developed. And so that controls impulse control, you know, judgment. So these kids don't know what they're, which it's clear when they killed the first person, they're like, oh my goodness, what have we done?
Right.
And they run off.
Right. Well, and that is the explanation I'd like to take to my parents about why I was kind of a screw up in college. But let me not go down that path. The juvenile justice system really is focused in a very different way than the adult system as a result of that recognition. That's why in the juvenile justice system, the primary purpose is about rehabilitation.
Right.
And in the adult penal system, it is really just about punishment. The focus there is punishment. And it's because children's brains are different, and that's why people who commit crimes when they're minors can't be executed. Right? There was recently a U.S. Supreme Court case on that very point. But it's
very rare for a 12 and a 13-year-old to be tried as an adult.
Yeah, that's the part that
that's
I just
so
have a hard
young.
Time.
Usually, it's people who are right on the edge, like 17 years old, 16, a really horrible crime. Maybe they'll try them as an adult, but 12 and 13?
Right. Well, generally speaking, in order to be brought from juvenile court to adult court, you have to find that the person is not a fit and proper subject for the juvenile court system.
Right.
That's basically that we need to focus on punishment rather than just fixing them. And it's just hard to wrap your head around that in this particular case. Wow. Well, so these people are going to be getting out soon. It sounds like not a moment too soon. Well, and that this young man who's going to be getting out has done a lot to turn his life around.
Well, he is 29 years old. He's now an ordained minister. And she actually found love and marriage with a pen pal. So she, you know, while she was in custody, they're both going to get out. But I'll tell you, they're going to be on probation for the rest of their lives. So any little violation could send them back to prison. And here are two people who they don't know. They were 12 and 13 when they went in. They don't know how to take care of themselves. Mm. They don't know how to work the internet. I mean, they've got a huge learning curve. So,
Well, let's hope that story has a happy ending.
Yes.
Well, there is one other story with a happy ending. That the rock band Three Doors Down was doing a concert.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently from the stage, the singer observed that a member of the audience was acting badly towards a woman that was in the audience there. And he stopped them in mid-song to berate this guy who allegedly hit this woman.
Wow.
That's a little bit of chivalry, right?
I like that. And actually that he would notice that and that he would stop the concert. Supposedly it's the first time he's ever actually stopped the concert because he said this was a woman that was getting hit.
Right. And I think he was pretty vocal about it from the stage. Hang on. Hey, you don't hit a woman. He's yelling at the guy in the crowd. You just pushed a woman out of the way to get in a fight. Can I quote from him and say that he said, you dick?
You just did.
Are we allowed to say that? Or are we in there? Anyway, get him out of here. You don't hit a woman, dude. He told the security, and then they got that guy out of there. So I think that's a bit of social responsibility that's good.
It's interesting because there's a lot of fighting going on, I guess, that goes on at certain concerts. But this one, because it was a woman, he stood up for it.
You know what? So I think that chivalry is not dead, Lonnie, no matter what you say about me. But, here's one from the There's a Special Place in Hell Reserved for You, Dude file. There was a funeral going on in Niagara Falls, New York, and the hearse parked outside.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody went and stole that damn hearse.
Mm. Right in front, from in
right
front of the church.
In front of
the
church.
While the funeral was going on inside.
While the funeral is going on inside. Like, so, by the way, from the, I don't know if that's part of the stupid criminal, if that's a stupid criminal nomination. Like, what are you going to do with that stolen hearse? Like, right. I can't imagine. Is that a joyride or are you trying to flip that hearse?
Yeah, I don't know. It's going to be pretty easy to track down.
Yeah. Can you describe the car for me? Yeah, it's long, kind of like a station wagon. Although maybe this one just strikes home for me because of my own horrible hearse story. Hmm. Can I share over revealing stories from my childhood? I'll pretend I'm in analysis now. So when I was 15 years old, before I was old enough to drive, I was dating an older woman. She was 16.
Mm.
And she was a junior, wanted to go to the junior-senior prom, but because I was not old enough to drive, you know, how am I going to take her? And this is up in Ashland, Oregon, small town, like there were no limousine services, but my mom had this funky, crazy hippie friend. He was like, he wore Birkenstocks and made soap and crazy stuff. And he owned a hearse. Mm. And I convinced him that it would be a cool idea for him to drive me and my prom date to the prom in the hearse. And he had this like 1930s yellow cab driver's hat. And he played the limo driver. And I just thought it was the coolest thing and the greatest idea and so awesomely funny. And then we showed up at my date's house.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was not amused.
It was not a limo, Darren. Well, it was a hearse.
Let me say this. Two of us rode in the back of the hearse on the way to the prom. Only one rode in the hearse on the way out, and it was me. She broke up with me at the prom.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I can kind of see that one coming. I'm not sure why you didn't either.
Whose side are you on?
Oh, man. Well, okay. Moving on. So to cases that we're keeping our eye on, there is a case that's breaking right now. It's actually not a case yet, but it's something that I'm keeping my eye on because I think it's a fascinating area that shows, once again, that technology moves quickly and the laws do not. This is in the area of drones. As we know, we've all been talking about drones and the evolution of drones and how, you know, everybody is fascinated by them. And now they're so easily accessible and people are using them for all sorts of things. things like sports events and, you know, legitimate things. But there's no regulations really yet. I mean, the FAA says they're going to get on this. They need to get on it pretty quickly about who can actually pilot them. Do you need a license to do that? Can you attach things to the drones? Well, speaking of that, there is a college student out of Connecticut who, as part of a college project, a class project, attached a handgun to a drone, and then he videotaped the drone flying and the gun being shot, firing four shots. Now, this is done on private property into some woods. So once he put this on YouTube and it got massive amount of hits and law enforcement got involved, they said, you know, we don't see yet that there's a law that can apply to this, but we're going to keep looking because obviously this is a very dangerous thing to do. Now the FBI and the FAA are getting involved trying to figure out, you know, what can we do with this type of behavior? But it's fascinating that, you know, when the college student did it and his professor, they all thought it was fine. No one was hurt. It was on private property. But once again, this is a very dangerous area where people, you know, at some point, use your brains, people. I mean, attaching a handgun. What if that crashed somewhere? He didn't know where it was. What if a kid came upon it?
There's so many ways that that story can go wrong.
So many ways that could have gone, you know, deadly. Thank heavens it didn't. And hopefully, you know, people will be more aware now and say, let's use some common sense and let's lawmakers and the FAA get on top of this, you know, regulating this area.
Yeah, well, speaking of common sense, I've been keeping my eye on the case against Dylann Roof, the South Carolina shooter. And now the federal government, who is responsible for the prosecution in this matter, has indicated that Mr. Roof is going to be charged with a hate crime. And it's important because for a variety of reasons, but certainly it subjects Roof to additional punishment possibilities.
Right.
And I think it's also an important evolution in our thinking about crime. You know, here we've got, it's a hate crime because it was motivated due to racial beliefs and this desire to start a race war. And then also apparently by religious beliefs.
That's what the allegation, the indictment
is,
says.
Is yet another reason. It's important from the government standpoint, not just from the ability to use increased punishment or to visit increased punishment on Roof or any other defendants, but also in order to track criminal activity. The classification of crimes as hate crimes can have dramatic impact on budgets and resources that go into law enforcement. And, you know, there's something about hate crimes that's just so much more insidious, where if I commit a crime, if I burglarize your house, that's a crime against you and your property, and no one's going to argue that that's a good thing. But there's something even worse about hate crimes, where I'm motivated not just by my desire to do something towards you, but it is the plural you. It's the y'all. It's right. Being motivated by my desire to hurt a group, and there just seems to be something more more potent and ugly about that.
You know, it's interesting you point that out, Darren, because I ran the hate crimes unit for the LA DA's office here for 2 years. And it's interesting because people have an emotional response to these types of cases. They want to send a message. They want that legitimate title of, yes, this was a hate crime. This person was motivated. They targeted these victims for this reason. What's interesting is when you get in front of a jury, sometimes in these cases, they say, wait a minute, the crime is the crime. I mean, this person killed all of these people. It's a murder charge. Now you're asking me to get into this person's brain and actually police his thoughts. And some jurors have a real problem with that. They get anxious about that. And so sometimes it would kind of put the jury's attention away from the crime and start to say, well, wait a minute, should we be policing thoughts or not? But in this case, this South Carolina case,
yeah, I don't think they're going to run into that problem.
If there's ever been a clear case that it was, you know, hate motivated, that this was a legitimate hate crime, and I think jurors are going to have no problem finding that.
Yeah, simplicity is an important strategy in trial, in the presentation of material, especially if you're trying to persuade. And from on the side of the prosecution, you've got to get unanimity, right? You've got to get 12 people all persuaded towards one thing. So the more confusion that gets interjected, the more difficult that can be. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, I don't think they're going to have that same kind of confusion. Hey, let's talk about something that is that's a little competition that we have going.
This is one of our favorite parts of the show.
Yes. For some reason, this speaks to me. We call it Dumbest Criminals. And it's a little competition between Lonnie and me to see who can find the dumbest criminal activity. And by the way, people, do not be afraid to send your ideas, especially to me. Not that I'm competitive, but I need the help.
Now, here's the thing. We don't tell each other ahead of time which cases we've picked, so we're just as excited to hear the other person's. Yes. But I think I've got a good one.
Well, hang on a second. I just want to say to people who do want to tweet, please tweet suggestions to @IDCrimeFeed and use the hashtag CrimeFeedPodcast or hashtag Dumbest Criminals. And by the way, you can just tweet those ideas directly to me. Lonnie won't mind.
No. Okay, put them to both of us.
Okay. What's yours, Lonnie?
All right. Mine comes out of Pennsylvania today. So this guy, this dumb criminal, allegedly assaulted a man and stole his ATM card and then ran off. And I guess he just kept running because the police couldn't find him. It took them months and months, and they still hadn't found him. So the police officers in this jurisdiction have a Facebook page. Good for them. Smart tool. And they posted a mugshot. I'm guessing it was maybe the picture from the ATM camera. They posted it on their Facebook page, and they said, hey, anybody who recognizes this guy, contact the police with any information. Well, guess who one of the people was that responded?
No.
It was the guy himself. He was so proud of seeing a picture of himself that he took it and he posted it on his own Facebook page.
Oh, my God.
And he said under there, LOL, and then he threw out a rude taunt to the police officers, essentially saying how much he loved it and how stupid they were. Well, the police officers, no dummies, saw this and they were like, hey, stupid once, stupid twice. So they reached out to him on his Facebook page.
Did they have to friend him?
They did. They friended him and they sent a private message pretending to be an attractive woman.
Ah.
And they said, hey, would you like to get together for a drink? And he said, no, I don't. And then they said, okay, how about just a smoke? Let's share a cigarette. And he says, sure, okay. Oh. So he goes to the appointed place and he gets arrested.
Wow. Wait, so which part was the dumb part? The responding?
There are a lot of dumb parts on that one.
All right, well, let's see if I can trump that here. So, you know, there's a lot of dangers when it comes to macaroni salad. It's got mayo in it. If you leave it out too long, there could be a real problem. Absolutely. But here, police apprehended three burglary suspects by following a trail of macaroni salad that they left behind.
What?
Somebody broke into the Build-A-Burger restaurant and they grabbed the cash register, and they also grabbed the entire surveillance system from the store. And then they also took one final thing, a large bowl of macaroni salad.
Apparently, they were really good.
They were hungry. So they ended up, they attempted to escape via a nearby trail, something called the Greenway Trail. So as police are moving along the trail, they find cash register parts, surveillance system parts, rubber gloves, loose change, and a steady trail of macaroni salad, which apparently they were eating as they're trying to make their escape. Well, they ended up following that trail of macaroni salad right to the suspects, and there are now three guys who are in custody facing a variety of charges concerning burglary, criminal mischief, and larceny. No one has brought particular charges related to the macaroni salad, but I guess we'll have to see. So,
let's see if they can find one.
I guess the lesson here is you want to make sure before you go on your crime spree, eat first?
A full lunch? Yeah. It's like, don't go to the grocery store hungry. Okay. This one's going to be a hard one. I think Barry, our producer here, should make the decision once again. Unless you, Darren, think there's a clear winner.
I got to say, I think your guy gets the nod.
I don't know, the macaroni salad.
I don't know. No, I got to bow at Lonnie's feet on this one. She definitely, you know, this guy is felony stupid for the whole Facebook thing. And I'm just confused about why he would be okay to get together for a cigarette.
Not a drink.
I don't know. All right. Lonnie wins on that one. All right. Well, please. Clearly, I do need your suggestions. So, and anybody who wants to tweet us, check us out on Twitter at @IDCrimeFeed. And please remember the hashtags either CrimeFeedPodcast or #DumbestCriminals.
I I like that hashtag.
So I guess I've just got one more thing to say, Lonnie, and that is on behalf of my partner in crime,
Lonnie Coombs,
and I'm Darren Cavanocchi. Thank you so much for listening. We are so grateful to you. And remember, if you want more shocking true crime stories, watch Investigation Discovery or visit crimefeed.com.
Keeping you current on all things criminal, Crime Feed.
Crime Feed.
With Darren Cavanocchi and Lonnie Coombs.